Hello, and I'm really glad you can join me on Inside Education, your guide to the world of education from an Irish perspective on Community Radio Station 103.2 Dublin City FM. You can listen to or download past editions of Inside Education going back to 2009 on my website seandelaney.com/podcasts. And my name is indeed Sean Delaney, and I'd like to hear from you by email to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie or on Twitter with the handle @InsideEd. On this week's programme, I'm delighted to bring you the second part of my interview with Harvard University's Professor Susan Moore-Johnson. She is interested in teacher policy, organisational change and administrative practice, as well as leadership and the effects of collective bargaining on schools. She has directed the project on the next generation of teachers since 1998, and that project featured heavily on last week's programme. Another area of interest for Susan Moore-Johnson has been the Public Education Leadership Project. That was a collaboration between Harvard's Business School and its School of Education. I began this week's part of the interview by asking Susan Moore-Johnson what that project involved.
Well, that was a very interesting project, which was we were able to initiate, though I wasn't there at the very beginning of it, because there was a very large grant from an alumni class at the business school. And so there were some people at the business school who were very interested in public education. They basically had the skills and knowledge of organizational and business research, where we had much more experience with the education side. The focus was not on curriculum and instruction, but really on the management of large urban school districts. And so over the course of the time I was there and from the beginning, really, we had both a research and a development piece with a number of large partner school districts. So each summer we would bring teams of 8 to 10 people from these districts for a full week of early morning to late in the evening work, both in plenary sessions discussing teaching cases that we had written, often based on their experiences, and also working with a faculty member as a consultant to their team on a particular problem of practice. Initially, the superintendents wanted to bring their cabinets so that they could use the time to work with their people. But we insisted successfully that they bring a range of people, including school-based people, principals, teacher union people, teacher leaders, school board members, so that as they thought about new policies that they wanted to introduce, that it would be with an anticipation, really, of what they would need to think about in implementing those policies. We developed a partnership with many of these districts that was very powerful for us in understanding districts, and I think for them, I know for them, in supporting their development. We wrote a number of teaching cases that are now available through a Harvard Business School publishing group, and I think they're actually free. That was the intention, and whether they ever actually followed through with that as a publisher, I'm not sure, but they're available for people to look at. And
these are case studies into management of schools.
Yeah, and they're designed as teaching cases, so they're stories. They're not academic in a sense, but well-documented stories about some particular period or some issue. So, for example, Baltimore City Public Schools highly decentralized their practices, so individual schools had a lot of responsibility. And so we wrote a case about that, and then they were in the room when we talked about it, and the other districts learned from it. And so there were a number of cases like that. We have a casebook that we published. So that's part of what the business school calls research. We at the Ed School wouldn't call it research, but it's very valuable. And then a year ago, we wrote a book about the relationship of districts and schools in 5 well-regarded, high-performing school districts. And we were very interested in the question of whether centralizing and standardizing practices within a school district was more effective than decentralizing them, or what that relationship was. And essentially, our conclusion was that it wasn't whether a district was centralized or decentralized, but how it was done. So If you decentralize responsibility and hand it to the schools, then the district has to have a means of supporting those individual schools in learning how to budget, for example, or supporting their recruitment of teachers so that it wasn't just letting them go. If you were centralizing, then you had to have a mechanism to be sure that the decisions that were made centrally were informed and reviewed constantly by the people in the schools that had to work on them. I think out of the body, first, certainly the one-to-one work with districts, which continues, and the body of case studies, and we get printouts of where people are buying them. They're internationally very much in demand. And also the book that we've done, which is much more, it's very reader-friendly, but it's much more conventional research. I think that is the kind of impact of PELP, as we call it.
And it was more at an administrative level then rather than at an instructional level.
That's exactly. It really was exclusively, often the issues of instruction kind of bubbled up into it, but the question was, how do you manage a system of schools? And that our school districts are intended as a unit to make the public education system be responsive to local political investment of the citizens. I don't mean political in a negative sense, but that's how the U.S. and its highly decentralized system has enabled citizens to take responsibility for their schools. And so the district is there to ensure both efficiency and equity, and it's probably been better at the efficiency side than the equity side. So the ongoing issues of race and social class, and those are district level issues. And I think that there's plenty to talk about there without ever saying, are we doing direct instruction or project-based instruction? Though that seeps into the cases, especially when those of us who are writing them are very interested in classrooms. So.
And what kind of learning was possible, say, about organizations and about administration, say, from the business school that mightn't have, arisen in the education school or vice versa?
Yeah, I think that the education school brought a lot of knowledge about how school districts currently work. There were just a lot of people involved who knew about the differences between, say, highly decentralized and centralized districts. And also many of the organizational elements, the role of school boards in all this. The business school had various people who had done research in other sectors, and this was a very important part, that a sense that public education was too inbred and inward-looking and not informed by other kinds of work settings. So, for example, there was a professor there who was very, very focused on the development of teams within other sectors, especially healthcare. And she had a whole set of concepts about creating what she called a psychologically safe environment, where the participants were really encouraged and protected if they wanted to raise concerns about how their unit was operating. That was, in some ways, one of the most influential ideas that our superintendents took away. These people who have, more authority than anyone else in the district, it never really had occurred to them that actually they are pushing down a kind of top-down authority compliance mechanism that actually might close off opportunities for development and expression of differences. So that there were just new ideas, and I think one of the great things was the faculty from both sides learned all the way along, from all of us, from the participants, but really from each other. Not always in a calm and easy way, I might say, but it was really productive.
Learning rarely happens in a calm and easy way.
Right. Not real learning. Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned there a few times the role of the superintendent, mm-hmm. and you also mentioned the word district, and they're terms that are probably not familiar to an Irish audience.
Right.
Could you say a little bit about the work of a superintendent and how that relates to a district in a way that could help someone who's not familiar with the system to understand it?
Well, this is a good question, and it's not the first time I've tried to answer it, and I'm not sure that I can convince anyone that it's a really useful mechanism. But because our schools are locally governed and funded, we do need a unit that's smaller than the state, especially in very large states, to oversee what happens in the schools. Now, I'm not sure that this particular approach is ideal, and yet it does live on. Essentially, a school district, and they can range in size enormously from a very small number of schools, say 3 or 4, to several hundred. So, you know, the Chicago school district is enormous and complicated, and then you will have a rural school district that's quite simple. But essentially, the superintendent, who is the chief educational officer, many of them are calling themselves CEOs these days, are responsible to work with the locally elected school board, which is responsible ultimately for the policies of the district, in ensuring that the school is successful in educating students, efficient and equitable. And so the job is a very complicated mix of educational understanding and authority and political interaction with the system that supports it. And so the superintendents in a small district might have 1 or 2 assistants, and they are overseeing the functioning of individual schools. In a large district like Chicago or Boston or New York City, there are subunits within the school district. So there's a set of intermediary administrators who report to the superintendent, who are overseeing both how individual schools work, but also particular programs. So federal support for education comes with many requirements attached, and also with a history of what's worked well and hasn't worked well. So the superintendent's office would be responsible for ensuring that those programs are legally administered and that the regulations are followed, but also to try to be sure that the money is well spent. The districts often will recruit teachers, and they are responsible for employing teachers, granting teachers tenure. The district level, in states that have a collective bargaining law which allows the unions to negotiate a contract, that happens at the district level. The superintendent would be very involved in that. And the way, again, just as an illustration of how locally controlled districts are, I think you have a national teachers contract. Many nations do. We do not. Every contract is negotiated locally.
At the district level.
At the district level. And they have a span of issues that they are permitted or required to bargain depending on state law. But they actually, within a state, you can see districts that are contiguous with extremely different contracts and labor relationships. So a lot of that sits in the superintendent's office as well. You know, they are responsible for the performance of their students. So under No Child Left Behind, a district in Boston or New York would have certain number of schools that the state level officials would intervene on. And so the superintendents are responsible for ensuring that the program actually meets standards.
And they're accountable to the Federal Department of Education?
No,
to the State Department of Education. Is it?
They're accountable locally and to the state primarily, and to the federal government if the funding for particular programs comes from the federal government. So it's kind of, it's a three-tiered setup, but they cannot be hired or fired by anyone but the local school boards.
And the school boards then, how are they related to the district?
They are elected by the citizens of the district in most cases. in some cases, see, everything has its variations in the U.S. There are school boards that are appointed by the mayor, who is locally elected. So indirectly or directly, they are all locally appointed or elected. Sometimes mayoral appointments actually lead to better informed school boards. Sometimes local elections lead to individuals who are single issue in their attention and actually aren't knowledgeable enough to really oversee the entire district. And so, again, in Boston, which I'm very familiar with, for many years it was an elected, fully elected school board from essentially different neighborhoods with representatives. And there was an increasing sense that it was dysfunctional because of that. It was a kind of combat for resources by neighborhoods which were racially and economically kind of segregated or very segregated. And so they moved to a mayoral appointment of school boards. And because we've had strong mayors who were willing to be informed about education, that has worked out well. Some places, you know, I think the record hasn't been quite so positive.
And every school has a board?
No. Again, no, the district has a board.
Okay, the district.
The school in some places has a board. So in Chicago, for example, there's been a state law for easily 15 years now creating what they call a local school council. And that school council is like a mini school board, and they hire and fire the principals. That is a very powerful and intriguing system, I would say, that's had both very favorable and some worrisome effects. But in most districts, it is a superintendent who hires the principal and can fire the principals. Yeah.
Okay, so I was interested in exploring that because you've written a book on the role of the superintendent. You've also written a book on teachers' unions in schools. What was that book about?
Well, that was a long time ago. That was actually my dissertation. So at that point, I was very interested in teacher unions because I had had a course in educational labor relations taught by a labor lawyer, not by an educator, he was an amazing educator, but education was not where he came from. And I became fascinated in the fact that so many local school districts were unionized and had contracts, and we knew very, very little about how that played out. And so there were large-scale analyses that were being done about the impact of collective bargaining on teacher wages, or an analysis of teacher contracts. I mean, we have 15,000 school districts, and so, you know, people would do a sample of looking at contracts and what are they doing there, and really inferring outcomes or effects on the basis of this contract language. Well, I had known from my own a little bit of research I did on another topic that the fact that something's in a contract doesn't mean that actually it drives what happens at the school. And there had been really no research about this, what happens in the school. I'm a qualitative researcher primarily, and so I was fortunate enough to get some funding, did a study of, I believe it was six districts, I think that's right, from a tiny little urban district in Oregon to Philadelphia. So huge differences in size, in the kind of union, in whether the national union was the American Federation of Teachers or the National Education Association. And within each of those districts, I visited schools and interviewed lots of people about the contract, how it affected them, the labor relationship, and essentially found that there's tremendous variation from school to school. And once again, that it's the principal who essentially works to define the labor relations. So you have a school where, you know, the teachers and the principals are really toe-to-toe, forcefully enforcing the contract and not trusting each other much at all. Another school within the same district, so it's the same overall labor relationship, where the contract is a kind of guidance, where the relationship is one of give and take, and where really it is the professional relationships of the people that are driving the interpretation of the contract. So that was in, I think I finished in 1982. I think today everyone understands that, well, everyone in education understands that kind of variation. I think there are still very strong anti-union forces that believe that there's one union in the U.S. that drives policy from the top to the bottom. But that's what that book was about.
And the unions today, like, what are the main teacher unions now?
The main teacher unions continue to be the National Education Association, which is the largest, and the American Federation of Teachers, which is affiliated with the AFL-CIO, which is a much broader union, although they're quite separate in practice. The AFT has long been the organizer of the large urban school districts, though not all of them. Different states have different proportions of local districts, and so the local district under labor law, and this is reaches well beyond education, the local district has the right to decide who will represent them, the local union. And so those decisions have, for the most part, been decided years and years ago, and so there's a continuation. In California, they have merged, and so the California Teachers Association, which historically was an NEA district, is now jointly affiliated with the AFT. That's also the case in New York. So the divisions are not quite so clear. The organizations themselves are very different in how they operate. In the NEA, there are term limits for the president, and there's a regular turnover. In the AFT, there have been very few presidents since the union was organized in the 60s. But there's a lot of similarity in the policies and the practices that they have.
And given what you've said earlier, that schools tend to be organized at a local level, is the key role of the unions at local level, or can they negotiate nationally?
No, they can't.
That's
they can't
thinking.
Negotiate nationally. And honestly, that would be a surprise to at least a third to a half of the U.S. population that thinks they know what goes on. No, the only legal bargaining agents are at the local level, and not all states are allowed to bargain. There have always been a handful, Texas, Virginia, North Carolina, that were prohibited from bargaining. In those states, the unions are still very active at the state level, but more as lobbyists and advocates of state policy. So they don't disappear, but there is no formal contract. But recently in Wisconsin, where teachers had bargained for years and years, Scott Walker, who's the governor, successfully eliminated through the legislature collective bargaining for teachers. So there's a lot of interest right now in what difference that will make. There's a lot of dissatisfaction among many people about that decision, because currently now there's no formal mechanism for teachers to actually influence some of the policies that they had been able to be very influential about, collaborate about. It's kind of driven a wedge in some of the collaboration.
And would most teachers join unions?
Well, every question you ask is more complicated than yes or no. The states differ in whether they have what's called a fair share or agency fee, meaning that in Massachusetts, for example, if I teach in a unionized district, then I can either join my union or I can pay a certain amount of, it's not dues, but essentially a stipend that supports the efforts of bargaining by the union. Now, over time, the difference between a membership fee and the agency fee has shrunk. And so essentially in Massachusetts, most of the teachers actually do join the union, and except those who object, because they have to pay the money anyway. That's at one end. At the other end are states that prohibit agency fee. And the unions really have to get their funding on the basis of memberships. And so the orientations of the presidents in those two settings are quite different. There was an enormously important Supreme Court case brought by some teachers in California that challenged whether it was an abridgment of some right. I'm not quite sure I recall just which one it was, that teachers would be obliged to pay an agency fee. And that is a decision that was pending for, it was argued in the court before Justice Scalia's death, and it was pending. And because the court was 4-4, and everyone agrees that it would have gone against the teacher unions if, you know, Scalia had continued, it was now sent back and rejected. So they are going to have to start all over again. So the unions had a reprieve on this. But I think, you know, depending on who's appointed to our Supreme Court next, this will be have big effects there.
We're coming near the end, Susan, and I just want to ask you one or two things about your career.
Yeah.
You said that you started off as a high school teacher.
Right.
How did you get to become a professor at the Harvard Graduate School of
I
Education?
Don't know. A series of accidents, I think. I was a teacher, and I happened to be in an extraordinary school district with one high school that was very well known for its professional treatment of teachers. Teachers were very important and supported. I had a role that was an administrative role in the school where I taught part-time and I was responsible for 200 students in the school. And I got to see the larger system as part of that group of administrators. So I had thought that I would be a superintendent. That was actually what interested me when I went to graduate school at Harvard. At the time, I had young children, and I, like many people, got bitten by the bug of research and got very interested in studying some of these policies from the perspective of teachers. So when I finished my dissertation, it was a time of the numbers of opportunities for administrative roles were shrinking temporarily because of enrollment declines. And I didn't see a position that I really wanted. And I realized that although I was fascinated by the issues, I was at that time in a position to study them more than I was to do them. So I stayed, and then a position came open, an academic position about the relationship of schools as organizations and teachers and teacher policy. So I applied, and I've just sort of been there ever since. Yeah.
And that was Susan Moore Johnson, who is the Jerome T. Murphy Research Professor of Education at Harvard Graduate School of Education, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. You can listen to podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email me to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.